Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Jeremiah chapter 50, which I will entitle Judgment on Babylon. Chapter 50 and 51 concern that topic, but I'm not going to be able to cover but half of chapter 50 in this audio, verses 1 through 28. Little bit of introduction here from Albert Barnes. Quote, "The similarity between passages in this prophecy and Isaiah illustrates the large knowledge which Jeremiah evidently possessed of the earlier scriptures and the manner in which, consciously or unconsciously, he has perpetually imitated them in his own writings." In other words, Isaiah prophesied about the destruction of Babylon, and Jeremiah is prophesying about the destruction of Babylon, and sometimes Jeremiah uses Isaiah's words. We start now in verses 1 through 3. "This is the word the Lord spoke through Jeremiah the prophet concerning Babylon and the land of the Babylonians. Announce and proclaim among the nations, lift up a banner and proclaim it. Keep nothing back, but say, Babylon will be captured, Bel will be put to shame, Marduk filled with terror. Her images will be put to shame and her idols filled with terror. A nation from the north will attack her and lay waste her land. No one will live in it. Both men and animals will flee away." So this word which Jeremiah spoke in verse 1, when did it arrive to Jeremiah from God? Well, Jeremiah 51, verse 59 tells us, as Albert Barnes points out, we read Jeremiah 51, 59. "This is what Jeremiah the prophet commanded Seraiah, son of Neriah, son of Maaseiah, the quartermaster, when he went to Babylon with King Zedekiah of Judah in the fourth year of Zedekiah's reign." And so basically, this prophecy in the next chapter, the prophecies against Babylon, went to Babylon so that the exiles could know that Babylon is going to experience judgment. And it happened in the fourth year of King Zedekiah's reign. Zedekiah reigned from 597 to 586, so the fourth year somewhere around 593 or so. Now, Babylon, you will recall, all the way through the book of Jeremiah, has been the instrument God is going to use to punish the people of Judah, which Babylon did in 586 when Babylon burnt the city of Jerusalem down and conquered the surrounding cities and made Judah, a province of Babylon. And that's true, but nevertheless, the instrument of God's wrath was still guilty of idolatry and was still subject to God's punishment, and that is going to happen now. Now, God tells Jeremiah to announce and proclaim among the nations in verse 2. Remember, it wasn't just the Jews who were trampled by Babylon. Babylon had wiped out Egypt in chapter 46 of Jeremiah, the Philistines in chapter 47, Moab in chapter 48, and in chapter 49, Ammon, Edom, Syria, Arabia, and Elam. And so the nations have an interest in this. They would like to see Babylonian wiped out. So God tells Jeremiah to lift up a banner, proclaim it, keep nothing back, but say Babylon will be captured, Bel will be put to shame. Who is Bel? Well, that's one of the chief idols of Babylon. Some think that Bel is a contraction of Baal, the Phoenician god, the male consort of Astarte, the female fertility goddess. But Bel will be put to shame. Marduk will be filled with terror. That was another Babylonian idol, very famous. Her images will be put to shame and her idols filled with terror. Now, of course, an idol is just a dumb piece of stone or wood. And so they're being personified here. They're filled with terror. They stand for the Babylonians, the idolaters, who are filled with terror. Verse 3, a nation from the north will attack her. Now, that could refer to a nation from the north of Judea. I don't think it does. If it does mean that, then it's referring to Persia, which is going to attack Babylon and destroy Babylon in 539 BC. Or it could refer to the north of Babylon, a nation from the north of Babylon, and I think that's what it is. If you look at the map, the Medes and the Persians, which of course was the Persian Empire, Babylon is a city which is about halfway down the Euphrates River, going from north to south, from Syria to the Persian Gulf, and that is the main city that was conquered by the Persians. And north of the city of Babylon, if you'll go east across the Tigris River, go north till you hit the Caspian Sea, that's Media, and then go south a little bit is Persia, but most of Persia was north of the city of Babylon. So it would make sense that Persia is coming from the north. Now we have a little problem here, because when Persia came from the north under the Cyrus the Great in 539, Cyrus indeed conquered Babylon, but he was pretty gentle with Babylon, didn't burn the city down, but verse 3 says that the nation from the north, i.e. Persia, will lay waste Babylon's land. No one will live in it. Both men and animals will flee away. That doesn't sound like what Cyrus the Great did to Babylon. Well, Poole says the answer is because this is not referring to only what Cyrus the Great did to Babylon. He conquered it, but Darius I, who ruled Persia from 522 to 486, he was not the immediate successor of Cyrus the Great. Cyrus ruled from 559 to 530, and then in 522, Darius I takes over. And at that time, Babylon, having been conquered, was a province of Persia, but then they revolted. So this is what Poole says. This prophecy, Jeremiah's prophecy, seemeth not to relate only to Cyrus's first taking of Babylon, that's 539, who dealt very gently with it, but to a second taking of it by Darius, the king of the Medes. Darius ruled from 522 to 486, who upon the Babylonians' defection from the Persian monarchy came and made a horrible devastation amongst them, hanging up, as some tell us, 4,000 of their nobles, and slaying multitudes of the common people. I'm assuming Poole uses his source Herodotus, who is the only ancient historian who tells of this revolt of Babylon and Babylon's subjugation by Darius I. Let me quote you from Herodotus. Thus Babylon was captured for the second time, and Darius, this is Darius I, after his victory, unlike Cyrus, its previous conqueror, destroyed its defenses, pulled down all the city gates, and impaled the leading citizens to the number of about 3,000. Poole says 4,000. I don't know why the difference is, but we get the idea. Now, this story that Herodotus tells of the subjugation of Babylon by the Persian king Darius is a great story. The Persians came against Babylon upon Babylon's rebellion to besiege the city. Over a year, they couldn't get in no matter what they tried. And the Babylonians, in order to save food, ordered all the women to be killed except for their mamas and a woman to bake their bread, which is really nice. You get your life saved because you can cook bread. And then they would mock the Babylonians. They would say, when a mule has a foal, that's when you're going to beat us. And of course, mules don't have foals. But then there was a gentleman, a noble of Persia, whose name was Zopyrus. Zopyrus has a great idea. He cuts off his ears. He cuts off his nose. He whips himself. He's a bloody mess. He goes to Darius and says, look at me, Darius, I've got an idea. And Darius says, what in the world have you done to yourself? He says, I'm going to pretend. Zopyrus says this. I'm going to pretend that you did this to me because I have told you, Darius, that you're not going to get the city of Babylon. It's impossible. And so I'm going to tell the Babylonians that you mutilated me like this, so they will believe me when I tell them that I am deserting from Persia and going over to Babylon. So Zopyrus goes to Babylon. He prearranges with Darius to send three waves of Persian troops in, 1,000 the first time, second date, 2,000 the last date, 4,000. And Zopyrus, leading Babylonian troops, kills 7,000 in three different waves, 7,000 Persian troops. And by this time, the Babylonians are thinking, whoa, this guy means business. He's on our side. Well, after that happened, according to prearranged plan, Darius I sends in some more troops. So Cyrus opens the gate. Babylon was betrayed, and in come the parrot, and in come the Persian troops, and they destroy Babylon. I think that is what Jeremiah was talking about here. Now, there's been another suggestion by Poole that he could refer to Seleucus Nicanor, that's Seleucus I, Nicator, reigned from 305 to 281, one of the successor generals to Alexander the Great. Poole says he is said to have built a city, which he calls Seleucia, within 410 miles of Babylon, 90 miles of Babylon, by which means he brought Babylon to an utter desolation. I don't know the history of that. I take Poole's word for it, but I think the best thing is Herodotus' story of Zopyrus and Darius I wiping out Babylon. All right, so we go now to verses 4 through 5 in Jeremiah 50. In those days, at that time, declares the Lord, the people of Israel and the people of Judah together will go in tears to seek the Lord their God. They will ask the way to Zion and turn their faces toward it. They will come and bind themselves to the Lord in an everlasting covenant that will not be forgotten. At that time, declares the Lord, what time? Well, I'm going to give you three options. Option number one is referring to Ezra's return when he brought the exiles back from Babylon in about 538 after Babylon had been captured by Persia. Option number two, the times of the gospel. Option number three, Ezra's return. And 538 is a type of the gospel. If you have been listening to my other audios, you know this is your typical options of all these prophecies. Well, let's see if it can be fulfilled literally with Ezra's return in 538 or so. We've got a problem right off the bat because Jeremiah says, at that time, the people of Israel and the people of Judah, that's the 10 northern tribes, Israel, and the 2 southern tribes, Judah, they will come together. That didn't happen in 538, at least not with a great number of people from the 10 tribes of northern Israel. However, you could say that this ministry was fulfilled at least in part when some of the 10 tribes of Israel joined Judah in a covenant with God. We've been pointing this out as we go through that Jews scattered all throughout the ancient Near East, especially in the Mesopotamian Valley, when they were carried into exile in 722 by Sargon II of Assyria. These Jews, when they find out that the city of Jerusalem is being restored, it is only natural that they're going to, some of them at least, are going to leave their temporary homes and go back to Jerusalem. They might have been from northern Israel, but since Jerusalem is there, Judah's there, they'll go to Judah. That's the closest they can get. Now, there is another problem with taking verse 4 as referring to the return from exile under Ezra in 538 or so B.C., because as they come back to Zion, back to Jerusalem, they will bind themselves to the Lord in an everlasting covenant. That sounds like the new covenant. And of course, Zion can be the physical Jerusalem, but it's also a well-known metaphor for the New Testament church. So some people prefer option number two, that the time of fulfillment of this prophecy of Jeremiah's is the time of the gospel. So let me give you some arguments in favor of that view. First of all, Jeremiah 50 verse 4 says that Israel and Judah return together. And you can make a strong argument. And you can make a strong argument that Israel, the northern 10 tribes, did not return unto Ezra. Sure, there were some stragglers coming in, but as a body, they didn't come back like they did under Ezra from like Judah did under Ezra. So that's argument number one in favor of the times of the gospel being the fulfillment time. Argument number two, Ezra's returnees in 538 B.C. or so did not return in tears. But Jeremiah says in chapter 50, verse 4, the people of Israel and the people of Judah together will go in tears to seek the Lord their God. But at the time of Ezra, circa 538, those returnees did not return in tears. We read in Psalms 126, verses 1 and 2, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. Our mouths were filled with laughter then, and our tongues with shouts of joy. Then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. So that doesn't sound like they're crying. Well, how do you answer that? Well, the only way to answer it is that the tears are tears of joy. And so you could say, no, this is referring to... And so you could say, no, this is referring to Ezra's return, circa 538 B.C. They returned in tears, all right, crying tears of joy. And the third argument that argues that the fulfillment of this covenant happens in the new covenant era is because the returnees are going to make an everlasting covenant. That sounds like the new covenant. Well, you can answer that argument by saying, well, the Jews have made an everlasting covenant with Yahweh not to commit idolatry, because they never have, not since they came back in 538. So you can make a good argument that Jeremiah is referring to Ezra's return in 538, or you can make the argument that no, he's referring to the times of the gospel when the Jews come into the church, as well as believing Jews come into the church. Option number three is a combination of both the first two options. Jeremiah is referring to the return, and that return is a type of the flow of converted Jews and Gentiles into the church in the times of Messiah Jesus. That's the option I prefer, option number three. Now, here are some scriptures which commentators have used to attempt to show that Old Testament prophecies are referring to conversions in the time of the gospel. Jeremiah 31 verse 9, they will come weeping, but I will bring them back with consolation. I will lead them to wadis filled with water by a smooth way where they will not stumble. For I am Israel's father, and Ephraim is my firstborn. So there's what I call a return verse, Hosea 1:11, and the Judeans and the Israelites will be gathered together. They will appoint for themselves a single ruler and go up from the land, for the day of Jezreel will be great. That's talking about a return, but it could be a typological return, referring to people flowing into the kingdom after Jesus comes. And then Zechariah 12:10, then I will pour out a spirit of grace and prayer on the house of David and the residents of Jerusalem, and they will look at me whom they pierced. They will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child and weep bitterly for him who weeps for a firstborn. Of course, that refers to Jesus. There's no question about that. I just mentioned these verses to show that the Old Testament prophets were looking forward to Jesus the Messiah at the first coming, not a so-called millennium, in my humble opinion. They prophesied about historical events, but they were really looking forward to Jesus the Messiah. And as many, many, many commentators say, and I believe correctly so, that this return from Babylon to Zion to Jerusalem is a type of Christians coming into the new Zion, the church. We go now to Jeremiah 50, verses 6 through 10. Yahweh continues, "My people have been lost sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray and caused them to roam on the mountains. They wandered over mountain and hill and forgot their own resting place. Whoever found them devoured them. Their enemies said, 'We are not guilty, for they sinned against the Lord, their true pastor, the Lord, the hope of their fathers.' Flee out of Babylon. Leave the land of the Babylonians and be like the goats that lead the flock. For I will stir up and bring against Babylon an alliance of great nations from the land of the north. They will take up their positions against her, and from the north she will be captured. Their arrows will be like skilled warriors who do not return empty-handed. So Babylonia will be plundered. All who plunder her will have their fill, declares the Lord." In verse 6, Yahweh says that the shepherds of Judah have led the people to the mountains. Well, on the mountains is where idolatry was going on. That was a typical place to put a shrine, an idolatrous shrine, up on a mountain. Get closer to God that way, they thought. And so the people wandered over mountain and hill, forgot their own resting place. Resting place is either the promised land or God. They forgot that they were Israel, the land of God. Or they just forgot that they rested in God securely. Either way. Verse 7, "Whoever found them devoured them." Now, going through Jeremiah, I have become quite used to the enemies of Israel. So I'm going to start at the north and move clockwise. Syria, Ammon, Moab, Edom, Egypt, the Philistines, Tyre, and Sidon. The Old Testament is full of conflict between these nations and the Israelites. I can give examples over all of those nations except maybe Tyre and Sidon, because at one time Israel was allied with Tyre. But nonetheless, Tyre and Sidon are said to be judged in Jeremiah 25. So I'm sure that they fought at some point, Tyre and Sidon and Israel. And so the enemy said, "We're not guilty," when they attacked the Israelites. Why? Because the Israelites have sinned against Yahweh. Well, that's true. They may have, but they hadn't sinned against the Babylonians. The Babylonians didn't have any business wiping out the Israelites. Yahweh wasn't their God. They're trying to defend Yahweh's honor? I don't think so. So they're using this as an excuse. It's really ironic that Israel's enemies would be worried about Israel sinning against Yahweh, since the enemies didn't believe in Yahweh. But I think what they're saying is that Israel was sinning against Yahweh, and that was like a pagan nation sinning against its own God. And Babylonia, being a pagan nation, knew that that was bad business. You don't sin against the God that's protecting you. That's just plain stupid. I think that's what they're saying, since Israel has offended what Babylon thinks is a mere local deity, then it makes sense that that local deity is no longer defending Israel, and so Babylon is able to take Judah. Now, I think that's a reasonable explanation of why the enemies are justifying themselves and attacking Judah, because Judah has disobeyed Yahweh. However, it is somewhat strange, and Ellicott thinks it's so strange, that it's not the fact that the enemies are speaking. Here's what Ellicott says. "The words can scarcely be thought of as those of the enemies of Israel, but is added by the prophet to emphasize the guilt of his own people." Well, but that's not what it says. Yahweh says in verse 7, "Their enemies said." It didn't say Jeremiah said the enemy said. In verse 8, Yahweh says, "You Babylonians, you need to be like he-goats that lead the flock." A he-goat is a leader. Well, the King James says he-goats. A he-goat leads the flock. He's the man. He's the masculine leader. And so Yahweh is telling the Babylonians, you need to find somebody that'll lead you out of Dodge, out of Babylon, because you're going down. Verse 9, Yahweh says, I'm going to store up and bring against Babylon an alliance of great nations from the land of the north. That would be the Medes and the Persians, who were allied together in the great Medo-Persian Empire. And as I've said earlier, they came from the north because geographically that's where they came from. We go now to Jeremiah 50, verses 11 through 16. Because you rejoice and are glad, you who pillage my inheritance, talking to the Babylonians, because you frolic like a heifer threshing grain and neigh like stallions, your mother will be greatly ashamed. She who gave you birth will be disgraced. She will be the least of the nations, a wilderness, a dry land, a desert. Because of the Lord's anger, she will not be inhabited, but will be completely desolate. All who pass Babylon will be horrified and scoff because of all her wounds. Take up your positions around Babylon, all you who draw the bow. Shoot at her. Spare no arrows, for she has sinned against the Lord. Shout against her on every side. She surrenders. Her towers fall. Her walls are torn down. Since this is the vengeance of the Lord, take vengeance on her. Do to her as she has done to others. Cut off from Babylon the sower and the reaper with his sickle at harvest. Because of the sword of the oppressor, let everyone return to his own people. Let everyone flee to his own land. Now in verse 11, Yahweh compares Babylon to a frolicking heifer that's threshing grain. In other words, he's walking all over the grain, rolling around, having a good old time. Now, by law, a heifer could not be muzzled. So this heifer is eating and growing fat. And that's what Babylon was doing, eating up nations surrounding it and growing fat. Yahweh says that Babylon was neighing like stallions. John Gill suggests that this is referring to horses who have sniffed victory. He also suggests perhaps it refers to horses in heat, signifying the Babylonians' impetuous lust for women. It's not very complimentary. Verse 12, Yahweh says, your mother will be greatly ashamed. Well, who is the Babylonians' mother? That's the mother city of Babylon. The kingdom of Babylon had a city called Babylon. She who gave you birth will be disgraced. The city of Babylon was disgraced when it was taken by Cyrus, by the Persians. She will be the least of the nations, a wilderness, a dry land, a desert. Now, that didn't happen at the time of Cyrus. We'll need to talk about that a little bit later. Here are two other places in Jeremiah where Jeremiah has said that Babylon will be a wilderness. Jeremiah 50, verse 3, that's in this chapter. Verse 3, for a nation from the north will come against her. It will make her land desolate. No one will be living in it. Both man and beast will escape. Now, of course, that didn't happen under Cyrus, but we'll deal with that in a little bit. Jeremiah 25, verses 15, and later on in verse 26 of Jeremiah 25, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me. Take this cup of the wine of wrath from my hand and make all the nations I am sending you to drink from it. And then there's a long list of nations. We get down to verse 26. All the kings of the north, both near and far from one another, that is, all the kingdoms of the world which are on the face of the earth. And then, finally, the king of Shishak, Shishak's another word for Babylon, will drink after them. So all the kings of the earth are going down, and Babylon's going to be one of them. And this is just another prophecy that confirms what Jeremiah has already prophesied. Verse 13, because of God's anger, Babylon will be completely desolate. People who pass Babylon will be horrified and scoff because of her wounds. Verse 14, Jeremiah says, take up your positions around Babylon. Or God says that. And of course, that's referring to the Persians. All you who draw the bow, the Persians were noted for their archery. Shoot at her, spare no arrows, for she has sinned against the Lord. Shout against her on every side. She surrenders, her towers fall, her walls are torn down. I'm not sure that happened when Cyrus the Great's army took Babylon in 539 at the time of Belshazzar's feast. I'm not sure her towers fell and her walls were torn down, however they were at a later attack of the Persians, which I'm going to talk about in just a minute. This is the vengeance of the Lord. Take vengeance on her. God has every right to do that, of course. Do to her as she's done to others. Tit for tat, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Verse 16, cut off from Babylon the sower and the reaper with his sickle at harvest. In other words, no more agricultural prosperity for you. Because of the sword of the oppressor, let everyone return to his own people. Now God is speaking to people who might be in Babylon at the time that the Persians come up. That would be representatives of nations who were doing business with Babylon, maybe diplomats, maybe allies who had fought with Babylon. And of course, those allies could have fought voluntarily, or they could have been forced to fight with Babylon. But at any rate, When they see the Persians coming, they need to get out of Dodge. We're going out of Jeremiah 50, verses 17 through 20. Yahweh continues, Israel is a scattered flock that lions have chased away. The first to devour him was the king of Assyria, that was 722, Sargon II. The last to crush his bones was Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Now, that's probably not 586 because this is written in the past tense. Jeremiah, of course, was written circa 593, the fourth year of Zedekiah, when he wrote this prophecy. And so he's probably referring to what happened about 5 years earlier in 597 when the Babylonians came in and carried Jehoiachin off into exile, King Jehoiachin. And so Israel has now been scattered because of Assyria and Babylon. Verse 18, therefore, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says, I will punish the king of Babylon and his land. Now, that doesn't refer to Nebuchadnezzar personally, because Nebuchadnezzar never got punished. The kingdom did not fall under Nebuchadnezzar. It did fall under Belshazzar, 539 with Cyrus. It also fell under Darius the First, which I'm going to relate to you in just a minute. So in verse 18, God says, I'm going to punish the king of Babylon, just like I punished in the past the king of Assyria. Assyria, of course, went down under the Babylonians. They fell to the Babylonians at the Battle of Carchemish, when Nebuchadnezzar was leading the Babylonians. That was in 605 BC. And that was just the remnants of the Assyrian army. They really had gone down earlier than that in 610 at Haran, and then 612 when Nineveh was destroyed, and took them a while to go down, but God punished them. And verse 19, but I will bring Israel back to his own pasture, and he will graze on Carmel and Bashan. Or verse 19, but I will bring Israel back to his own pasture, and he will graze on Carmel and Bashan. His appetite will be satisfied on the hills of Ephraim and Gilead. All right, here's some quick geography. Carmel is that beautiful hill next to the Mediterranean Sea at the northwestern corner of Israel. I've been on it. It's beautiful. It's pretty. It's at the head of the valley of Jezreel, halfway down, which is the famous place of Megiddo, where Armageddon will take place, or has taken place, depending on your view of eschatology. Bashan is that fruitful area east of the Sea of Galilee in the Golan Heights, famous place. Ephraim is the largest tribe of northern Israel. Samaria was the capital city. Ephraim was just to the north of the tribe of Benjamin and just to the south of the tribe of Manasseh. Gilead was that strip of land that extended from the southern end of the Sea of Galilee to the northern tip of the Dead Sea. It extended to the east of the Jordan River. Now, that makes it sound like the return that's being prophesied here is talking about the whole land of Israel, not just the southern two kingdoms. But remember, Israel was restored eventually under the Hasmoneans, and they got all of the land back during the Hasmonean dynasties in the intertestamental period. So I don't think that's a problem. Verse 20, in those days, at that time, declares the Lord, search will be made for Israel's guilt, but there will be none, and for the sins of Judah, but none will be found, for I will forgive the remnant I spare. Now, I made mention in verse 19 that Jeremiah is talking about all of Israel coming back, because he mentions the word Israel, which sometimes can refer just to Judah, but here it's obviously referring to northern Israel, because he mentions Carmel, Bashan, Ephraim, and Gilead, all of which are in northern Israel. And so we have a return that encompasses tribes that are more than just Judah and Benjamin. As John Gale says, this is not just a return of a few Levites and other remnants of the 10 tribes. It sounds like it's all of the 10 tribes, or at least a representative sample of the 10 tribes. So Gill says this is a representation of a final fulfillment of believing Jews coming into the church in the times of the Messiah, but I would point out another option. It could refer to the uniting of the kingdom under the Hasmoneans. I mentioned that earlier. They were in the intertestamental period, 5th century, 4th century, 3rd century BC. The nation was united then. And so it doesn't have to refer to a final fulfillment in the times of the Messiah. Now, of course, it could be a typical situation here where the physical return is a type of the spiritual conversion of the Jews. Now, in verse 20, God says, I will forgive the remnant I spare. You can look all you want, but you're not going to find Israel's guilt. Now, that's a forgiving God, because Israel was audaciously guilty of all sorts of crimes and sins against Yahweh. Well, what forgiveness is God speaking of? Is he speaking of forgiveness in Christ? I will forgive the remnant, and the remnant is the people of the Jews who are in Christ. I don't think so, because remnant sounds pretty small. I will forgive the remnant I spare. I think he's talking about the remnant that came back from Babylon. They will be forgiven of their idolatry. As a matter of fact, they never practice idolatry anymore. After that, post-exile, you will not find a Jew committing idolatry. And of course, it could be both. It could be forgiveness for the idolatry of the 6th century BC Jews, as well as forgiveness for all who become saved and come into the church at the end of the Jewish age and at the beginning of the New Covenant era. We go now to verses 21 through 28, and we will finish this chapter. Yahweh continues. He's speaking to the Persians now. Attack the land of Merathaim and those who live in Pekod. Pursue, kill, and completely destroy them, declares the Lord. Do everything I have commanded you. The noise of battle is in the land, the noise of great destruction. How broken and shattered is the hammer of the whole earth. How desolate is Babylon among the nations. I set a trap for you, O Babylon, and you were caught before you knew it. You were found and captured because you opposed the Lord. The Lord has opened his arsenal and brought out the weapons of his wrath, for the sovereign Lord Almighty has work to do in the land of the Babylonians. Come against her from afar. Break open her granaries. Pile her up like heaps of grain. Completely destroy her and leave her no remnant. Kill all her young bulls. Let them go down to the slaughter. Woe to them, for their day is come, the time for them to be punished. Listen to the fugitives and refugees from Babylon declaring in Zion how the Lord our God has taken vengeance. Vengeance for his temple. Now Jeremiah knows how to speak doom and gloom on a nation. He says in verse 21, or Yahweh does, attack the land of Merathaim. Couple of options for where that is. First of all, and this is the majority view from what I can tell, Merathaim is a figurative name for Babylon. As BibleAtlas.org says, it was a name used for Babylon in Jeremiah 50:21, where we are now. Strong's Hebrew Concordance says it means perhaps, quote, double rebellion, another name for Babylon. Well, if it means double rebellion, what does that mean? A couple of options on that. The Assyrians rebelled against God in 722, and now the Babylonians rebelling against God in 586. And of course, the Assyrians and Babylonians often considered to be really part of the same enemy because they're in the same geographical area in the Mesopotamian Valley. And Babylon is a province of Assyria, and sometimes Babylon gets in charge and they're in charge of Assyria. If you'll look at that ancient Near Eastern history like that. And so if you look at Merathaim as being a symbol for those in the Mesopotamian Valley who opposed God, it would be a double rebellion, once under the Assyrians and once under the Babylonians. Or the other way you could look at that term, double rebellion, is to say that the Babylonians' rebellion against God exceeded the rebellion against God of other nations. But at any rate, it would be symbolic, however you take that double rebellion. Adam Clark says, no such places as these are to be found anywhere else, and it is not likely that places are at all meant. Merathaim is plural. Clark says, it's not referring to a geographical location. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown agrees and says that Merathaim is a symbolical name for Babylon, the doubly rebellious, namely against God. The Webb Bible Encyclopedia says that the word's meaning is double rebellion, probably a symbolical name given to Babylon, denoting rebellion exceeding that of other nations. Well, I think that's what it is. However, the great German commentator Franz Delitzsch thinks it's an actual place. Net Bible quotes him on that and says that Merathaim is the region around the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates River. That's where the Tigris and Euphrates come together right before they empty into the channel that dumps into the Persian Gulf. Here's what International Standard Bible Encyclopedia says. According to Delitzsch, it may be equivalent to the Babylonian Maratun, i.e., land by the Nar Maratu, the Bitter River, which is the Persian Gulf. Well, that's all speculation. I think it's easy to just to say it's a great Merathaim is just a great name for Babylon, double rebellion. And for those who live in Pekod, well, what is Pekod? Smith's Bible Dictionary says that authorities are undecided as to the meaning of the term Pekod, so we'll look at some options. John Gill says that Pekod was a chief province of Assyria in which Nineveh, now overthrown, once lay. Gill quotes Ezekiel 23:23, the Babylonians and all the Chaldeans, Pekod, Shoah, and Koah, and all the Assyrians with them, desirable young men. Of course, that almost sounds like Pekod is a part of Chaldea, Babylonia, as well as Assyria, so who knows. That's option number one, the province where Nineveh was, used to be ruling. Option number two, this is from the Illustrated Bible Dictionary. Pekod is a small Aramean tribe east of the lower Tigris. That would be in Elam, right there when the Tigris is about to hit the Persian Gulf. And Strong's Concordance says that Pekod is a people in the Babylonian army and a tribe in southeast Babylonia bordering Elam. So they have it on the western side of the Tigris River in southeast Babylonia, not in Persia. But I think option number three is the best. Pekod is a symbolic allusion. The allusion is to the meaning of Pekod, which is visitation. The inhabitants whose time of deserved visitation and punishment is come. It's time for Babylon to be visited with punishment. I have a source here, which I think is something called the Expositor's Bible Dictionary, EBD. I'm not really sure. I couldn't find it. But one of my Bible dictionaries says, it is the opinion, however, of some that this word signifies visitation, punishment, and allegorically designates Babylon as the city which was to be destroyed. So, Jeremiah is saying, attack the land of the double rebellious and visit those who live there. Visit them with punishment. Pursue, kill, and completely destroy them. So Yahweh continues with battle descriptions, and then he says how broken and shattered is the hammer of the whole earth in verse 23. The hammer of the whole earth, of course, was Babylon, because they were smashing nations all around them. How desolate is Babylon among the nations? It's a wilderness. Verse 24, I set a trap for you, O Babylon, and you were caught before you knew it. Now that trap is probably referring to the way that Cyrus was able to capture the city of Babylon. He drained the river Euphrates, his army did. And then his army marched right up the middle of the dry bed of the Euphrates, right under the portcullis that was guarding the city of Babylon, right under the gates, went in, this was at night, took the city by surprise, while the Babylonians were feasting and reveling at Belshazzar's feast, all described in the book of Daniel. So Cyrus is trapped, and so Babylon is trapped in verse 24. Verse 25, God has opened his arsenal, brought out the weapons of his wrath. That would be Media and Persia. They're in God's arsenal. Sovereign Lord Almighty has work to do. In other words, the work of judgment. Come against her from afar. God tells the Persians, as Gill says, from the Persian Gulf and the Caspian Sea, on which the Persians and Medes bordered, from the most distant countries, for the Medes and Persians, who are here called unto, brought others along with them and their army from places still more remote. The Persian Empire spread to the east, and I don't know how far it spread at this particular time, but I mean, you're talking about all over into Central Asia, Afghanistan, over in what today is eastern Iran. So judgment is coming from afar against Babylon. Verse 27, kill all her young bulls. Why is God interested in talking about killing Babylon's bulls? Well, those bulls are symbols of Babylon's kings, captains, and warriors. In verse 26, backing up a verse again because I left this out, God tells the Persians to pile Babylon up like heaps of grain. Now, we have a translation issue here. The New American Bible says pile her up. The New American Bible says pile up her goods in heaps. The NASB says pile her up like heaps. Doesn't say what kind of heaps, just heaps in general. That's the NASB, the American Standard Version, the King James Version, and the Literal Version, Young's Literal Version. Bible in Basic English says, pile her up like a mass of stones. The Darby translation says, pile her up like sheaves. And similarly, God's Word says, pile her up like piles of grain. The NIV says, like heaps of grain. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, like mounds of grain. Of course, the NIV says, like heaps of grain. I think it's better just to translate it like pile her up like heaps, because then it's more graphic. It's heaps of bodies, human beings. Breaking open her granaries means that her food supply is going to be destroyed. And so in verse 27, God says, woe to the young bulls, the leaders, their day has come, they're going to be punished. Verse 28, listen to the fugitives and refugees from Babylon declaring in Zion how the Lord our God has taken vengeance. Now, if these fugitives are in Zion, that means they are Jewish refugees from Babylon. So some Jews escaped Babylon before Ezra's return in 538 B.C., sounds like it. Of course, it could refer to the fugitives who came back under Ezra in 538 B.C. At any rate, the news is going to get back in Jerusalem. Babylon has gone down. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. to quote that famous verse in the book of Revelation. Now, way back in verse 3, I mentioned that Jeremiah said that the nation from the north, Persia, will lay waste the land of the Babylonians. And I said there's a problem there because Cyrus didn't really lay waste Babylon. And I said I would deal with it later. Well, I've gone through a lot of other verses in this chapter talking about how Babylon is going to get whacked. But Cyrus didn't really do that to Babylon. He just took it over, the city of Babylon. So we need to deal with that little problem now, and after I deal with that, we will be finished with this chapter. The easiest solution to the problem is to say that Jeremiah is talking about the capture of Babylon by Persia, but it's not just Cyrus the Great. That was part of it, of course, but the Persians weren't finished with Babylon. Cyrus the Great ruled from 559 to 530. He conquered Babylon in 539, and a king who came after him, Darius I, king of Persia from 522 to 486, he really did a number on Babylon. This is a great story. This is what the Poole commentator says, Matthew Poole. This prophecy, the prophecy of Jeremiah, seemeth not to relate only to Cyrus's first taking of Babylon, who dealt very gently with Babylon, but to a second taking of Babylon by Darius the king of the Medes. That's Darius the first. Who upon their defection from the Persian monarchy, the Babylonians' defection, they rebelled, Darius came and made a horrible devastation amongst the Babylonians, hanging up, as some tell us, 4,000 of their nobles, and slaying multitudes of the common people. Now, I think that Poole is quoting Herodotus here. He doesn't tell us, but Herodotus gives us the story about Darius I taking Babylon. Babylon had already been taken by Cyrus. It is now a province of the Persian Empire, but they rebelled. So it's basically a civil war. And Herodotus says this, thus Babylon was captured for the second time. And Darius, after his victory, unlike Cyrus, its previous conqueror, destroyed its defenses, pulled down all the city gates, and impaled the leading citizens to the number of about 3,000. Poole says 4,000. Herodotus here says 3,000. I don't know why the difference, but the point is that Babylon went down. Now, that's a fantastic story in Herodotus, and I'm going to tell it to you real quick. When Babylon rebelled, Darius I was angry. He sent troops to besiege Babylon and failed. The siege was over a year. I think it was 19 months. It was a long, long time. He couldn't get in. And so finally, a Persian noble named Zopyrus has a great idea. He slices off his ears. He slices off his nose. He whips himself into a bloody pulp. And then goes to see the king, and Darius says, what in the world is the matter with you? What have you done this for? And he said, well, I had an idea. I'm going to pretend that I am deserting from the Persian army and that you caught me and did this to me. The reason I did it before telling you is because I knew you wouldn't let me do something this crazy. But I did it, and now that I've done it, I want to go to Babylon and pretend that I have been treated this badly because I told you, Darius, that you did not have a chance to conquer Babylon. And so Zopyrus goes to Babylon. Of course, they don't really believe him at first, but they think, well, he does look pretty beat up. And so they gave him charge of some Babylonian troops. And Zopyrus had arranged with Darius the first for Darius to send in three different waves of Persian troops against the city. One with 1,000 people in it. I think the next one had 2,000, and the next one 4,000. Three different waves, and Zopyrus volunteered to fight these Persians coming in, and he killed them all, sacrificed all these Persian troops, and so now the Babylonians really believe that he was a Babylonian now. He wasn't a Persian anymore. But after that, Darius I, at a prearranged time with Zopyrus, Darius I sent in another wave of Persian troops, and this time Zopyrus opened the walls of Babylon and let the troops of Darius come into the city and have their way and destroy it. So I think that's when Jeremiah's prophecy is fulfilled. Poole mentions another possibility. He says that Seleucus I Nicator, who ruled from 305 to 281, he was a Seleucid, one of the successor generals to Alexander the Great. He was said to have built a city, which he called Seleucia, about 90 miles away from Babylon. And by that city, he brought Babylon to an utter desolation. Sounds like a gradual thing. I don't think so. I think it's this attack in the affair of Zopyrus, the attack of Darius I on Babylon, that wiped it out. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're not finished with doom and gloom being pronounced upon the city of Babylon. In our next audio, we will stay in Jeremiah 50 and go to verses 29 through 46, and we will look at Judgment on Babylon, Part B. I hope to see you for that happy event, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.